This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
The Delta variant is causing COVID-19 cases to rise, but local governments are being less restrictive this time around.
They don't want businesses to shut down who are just now emerging from the pandemic. They do not want to stem the tide of economic recovery that is unfolding across the country.
And the infrastructure bill is facing Republican headwinds in the Senate. Plus, why non-compete clauses are getting a federal review. It's Wednesday, July 21st. I'm Charlie Turner for The Wall Street Journal, filling in for Anne-Marie Fertoli. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that move the world today. In a procedural vote today, Senate Republicans have blocked an effort to start debate on a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure deal still under negotiation. 49 senators voted in favor, short of the 60 votes needed. Senate Democratic leaders had hoped to start the process of moving both the infrastructure bill and a separate $3.5 trillion package of child care, climate, and other provisions expected to pass with only Democratic votes. Here's our Washington reporter, Andy Duren.
All of the lawmakers who have been working in these negotiations, it's a bipartisan group of Republican and Democratic senators. They all say that they're going to keep up negotiations over the next few days, and they are actually looking to try and take another procedural vote sometime next week to actually get things going. Right now, the Republicans say that, you know, they don't have a final product yet, or they don't have a full agreement yet, so they are unprepared to take this first procedural step, but they do think that they will soon have that agreement and that they would be able to move things forward. So right now, it looks like talks will continue and that there may be kind of a second wind here next week. But to be fair, there have been a few other times where this same group of folks has said that they have an agreement or they're near an agreement, and we're still not there yet. So we'll certainly be an interesting few days.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has rejected two of five Republicans chosen to serve on the Democratic-led Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol. Pelosi said the inclusion of Representatives Jim Jordan and Jim Banks would hurt the integrity of the probe, although she did not specify why. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy rejected suggested alternative picks by Pelosi and warned that unless the Speaker agrees to seat all five of his appointees, House Republicans would pursue a separate investigation instead. After more than 2 years of negotiations, states have unveiled the historic $26 billion settlement with drug companies that we reported on yesterday to resolve thousands of opioid crisis lawsuits. The agreement with the nation's three largest drug distributors and drug maker Johnson & Johnson could clear the way for money to be received by states as soon as early next year. J&J had no comment about the lawsuits. Separately, in an earnings call, the healthcare giant reported that greater demand for medical devices, drugs, and consumer health products boosted its sales and profit in the last quarter. J&J is considered a bellwether for the industry. The company also raised its guidance for the rest of the year, forecasting healthcare use to continue and sales of its COVID-19 vaccine to pick up. In other earnings news, Coca-Cola raised its outlook for both revenue and earnings per share for the rest of this year. The company said rising global sales were boosted by the reopening of restaurants, stadiums, and movie theaters. Coke's revenue in the most recent quarter soared above levels from a year earlier when sales plummeted during pandemic-related lockdowns, and even topped revenue in the same period in 2019. First-time buyers looking for a starter home may have to wait longer to hit that milestone. According to new research from Freddie Mac, the supply of entry-level housing is near a five-decade low. In the 70s, 418,000 new starter homes were built each year. Last year, that number was down to just 65,000. While the problem may be most acute in expensive metro areas like New York or San Francisco, experts at Freddie Mac say house hunters are facing the same problem all over the U.S. And JPMorgan Chase's board has awarded CEO Jamie Dimon new stock options as a retention bonus, signaling that the largest U.S. bank wants him to stay on for several more years. The 65-year-old Dimon has led the bank since 2005 and maintains that his retirement isn't a near-term event. But Dimon has had two significant health scares in recent years, including throat cancer in 2014 and an acute aortic dissection which required emergency heart surgery last year. In a regulatory filing, J.P. Morgan said the 1.5 million options will increase in value so long as the bank's stock price rises and become exercisable in 5 years. Coming up, how local governments are working to curb the Delta variant with a lighter touch.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
COVID cases have been on the rise across the U.S. because of the highly contagious Delta variant. At the same time, the pace of vaccinations has slowed considerably. So, what's next? How are local authorities trying to curb the spread while still keeping the economy up and running? With more on this, let's bring in Wall Street Journal reporter Dan Frosch. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, the pandemic has lasted more than 16 months. During that time, state and local authorities have tried a number of methods to slow the spread of COVID-19. Remind us of what they did and what proved to be the most effective.
Early on in the pandemic, states implemented mask mandates. We had lockdown orders. We had really sort of the most restrictive measures taken in those first few months of the pandemic when the scope of COVID really hit everyone by surprise. At that point in time, we just didn't know what was going on to a certain extent, right? And so states were under a tremendous amount of pressure from local public health authorities to just shut everything down and take a step back until we could figure out what the next steps were. And now that we have vaccines, which really came about 6 to 8 months after these initial very restrictive measures were enacted, the new rise in cases, in particular the Delta variant, poses sort of a unique challenge for states and local health authorities. Do they go back to some of these more restrictive measures because there is still a segment of the population that remain unvaccinated? Or do they double down on trying to get this group of folks who have not yet gotten vaccinated immunized as a way of blunting the spread? And so that's sort of where we're at right now.
The Delta variant is now the most widespread. We learned yesterday it accounts for more than 80% of new cases in the U.S., and hospitalizations and deaths are on the rise. How are various state and local governments responding this time around?
Largely, you see states and local health officials stopping short of those restrictive measures that we just addressed. They feel like they know who the folks are who have not yet gotten vaccinated. They've been able to sort of pinpoint the particular demographics. Oftentimes it is younger people, people between the ages of 20 and 40 who decided not to get vaccinated. And those are folks who are sort of, in many cases, driving this surge in cases. And so there is a sense that, hey, why don't we focus on these folks, try to get them immunized, and hopefully, at least for now, will be enough. Now, there are some places like Los Angeles County, for example, that have decided to revert back to some of the more restrictive measures that they implemented in those early days of the pandemic. Specifically, LA County earlier this month instituted an indoor mask mandate in crowded places. And they are stressing that this is sort of a short-term measure that they hope will blunt the rise in Delta cases in the area. But it is at some level, I think, disappointing for folks who felt like the pandemic really, to a certain extent, was over.
We saw stocks fall earlier this week, Dan, because of concerns about the Delta variant. When you talk to people on the local level, how much of a concern is the economic impact of more restrictive rules?
I think that the economic impact of those initial few months, which really hit the U.S. like a gut punch in those early days of the pandemic, I think that is certainly in the back of local officials' minds when they weigh what tools in their toolbox they should use to deal with the Delta variant. Virtually everybody that I've spoken with is not seriously considering some of those same restrictive measures. They don't want businesses to shut down who are just now emerging from the pandemic. They do not want to stem the tide of economic recovery that is unfolding across the country. And so that's why, for the most part, you're really not seeing many restrictive measures. And even in Los Angeles, where this new mask ordinance has been enacted, you know, this is being done at the local level. It's not statewide. The sheriff of Los Angeles County has said he's not going to enforce it, so it's really up to local businesses. So I think you're just not going to see that same sort of hammer approach, and for good reason, in that by and large, the people who are getting sick at this point are unvaccinated individuals. So the way local health officials see it, there's really no reason for us to restrict everyone when it is the unvaccinated individuals who are driving this surge.
Dan, the Biden administration has had a robust pro-vaccination campaign going. What's the messaging now?
The messaging now is that this is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That is the message you hear from the White House. That is the message we're hearing at the local level as well. And what you are hearing from local health authorities is that people who are unvaccinated are getting very sick. And you are going to get very sick unless you get vaccinated. And that message, coupled with an amplified public outreach, where you have local authorities trying to use people in communities who have a certain amount of influence in trying to get people vaccinated. You have mobile vaccination vans. You have nurses who will come to your house and get you vaccinated. And so there is just making it as easy as possible, in some cases paying people to get vaccinated, and trying to make the decision just sort of a no-brainer, both through emphasizing how dangerous it is if you remain unvaccinated, and then also just making it logistically an easy thing to get done.
Finally, Dan, what are local governments saying about the future? Back to work, back to school in the fall, especially if things get worse again?
Well, it's sort of a mixed bag. You have some schools and universities which have said you have to provide proof of vaccination before you can return to campus. The University of California system has done that. A federal judge recently ruled that Indiana University could require students to come back only if they had showed proof of vaccinations. And then conversely, you have numerous states, particularly red states like Arizona, who have made it illegal for schools and businesses to require proof of vaccination. So it's really sort of a hodgepodge of rules and regulations. And that theme has sort of been a common thread throughout this entire pandemic, right? Where you have different states and locations sort of making up their own rules as we go along here in terms of the level of restrictiveness that they're going to impose on their citizens with regards to COVID.
Wall Street Journal reporter Dan Frosch. Dan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And finally, if you've signed an employment contract, you may have also signed a non-compete clause. According to a survey by compensation data firm PayScale, nearly a third of U.S. companies use them for jobs ranging from barista and janitor positions to senior management. Well, those days may be numbered. Non-competes were supposed to protect the company's confidential information by preventing employees from sharing trade secrets with competing firms. But opponents say the contracts can scare workers into staying with one employer or force them to quit their careers altogether. Now, President Biden is asking the Federal Trade Commission to ban or limit the clauses. Here's our workplace reporter, Lauren Weber.
President Biden wants to rein these in, and non-competes have been a target for a long time of many worker advocates. And he's basically saying this is part of a pro-competition order where he wants to improve competition for businesses, but also for workers, and give workers the ability to move around freely, which also means they have more ability to raise their wages, because often people will get a bigger bump in their salary or income when they switch jobs.
We'll have more about those non-competes on our sister podcast, Your Money Briefing, tomorrow morning. And that's what's news for this Wednesday afternoon. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charlie Turner for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.